Hello, and welcome to Malice Aforethought UK, a true crime podcast, website, blog, and forum, looking at some of the lesser known and more well known true crimes from here in the UK and across the globe. Today I'm taking us back to my hometown of Hull, which is in the East Riding of Yorkshire, on the northeast coast of England. And for those not familiar with Hull, it is an old fishing town or city with approximately 250,000 people. It's also a ferry terminal and is known for its unusual accent. So apologies for any new listeners to my Hull accent. I try my best to make sure that I am understandable. And famous people from Hull include Maureen Lipman and the comedian Lucy Beaumont. It's also the place where the House Martins and the Beautiful South started. And it's a place that I've called home for my whole life. So this story is very familiar to me, but it's not so familiar to the wider public, which is unusual because it does relate to a death in police custody of a black male, and it happened about 20 something years ago. Recently, we've seen many cases of deaths caused by police during or after the arrest of an alleged offender, and following the tragic death in May 2020 of George Floyd in the United States and the ensuing trial of Derek Chauvin, the world stood up and paid attention. The Black Lives Matter movement gained momentum, and George's death was caught on smartphones by numerous individuals who witnessed him begging for his life as he could not breathe while Chauvin knelt callously on his neck. However, as mentioned, George's death was not a new phenomenon, and neither was it a unique case of a death in the custody of a police officer being caught on camera. But because of social media and the individuals who witnessed the brutality in a public street being able to upload the shocking footage from their devices to the public in real time, we were forced to confront George's tragedy head on. But today, as I say, I'm returning to my hometown of Hull and discussing a case of a death in police custody that took place 20 years before George's. And I want to make an attempt to draw attention to this case. Again, like George, the victim was a black male, and again, it was caught on camera, but this time it was caught on the very CCTV cameras in the custody suite that are put there to protect the prisoners from harm, either self-inflicted or otherwise. This is the story of Christopher Alder. Before I continue with Christopher's story, here is some background facts about what is considered a death in police custody. According to the College of Policing, in the UK there are five categories which define a death in custody or a death following contact with the police. A category 1 is a road traffic fatality. This includes deaths of motorists, cyclists or pedestrians arising from police pursuits, police vehicles responding to emergency calls, and other police-related activity. This obviously does not include a death following a road traffic accident or incident where the police have attended immediately after the event as an emergency service. Category 2 is a fatal shooting, including fatalities where police officers fired the fatal shot using a conventional firearm. Category 3 deaths are deaths in or following police custody, including deaths that occur while a person is being arrested or taken into detention, deaths of people who have been arrested or are being detained by the police under the Mental Health Act of 1983. The death may have taken place on police, private or medical premises, in a public place or in a police or other vehicle. This does include deaths that occur during or following police custody where injuries have contributed to the death were sustained during the period of detention, deaths that occur in or on the way to hospital or other medical premises following or during the transfer from scene of arrest or police custody, deaths that occur as a result of injuries or other medical problems that are identified or that develop while a person is in custody, or deaths that occur while a person is in police custody having been detained under Section 136 of the Mental Health Act 1983 or other related legislation. It does not include suicides that occur after a person has been released from police custody and deaths that occur where the police are called to assist medical staff to restrain individuals who are not under arrest. Category 4 would be apparent suicides that occur within 2 days of release from police custody and apparent suicides that occur beyond 2 days of release from custody where the period spent in custody may be relevant to the subsequent death. Category 5 are deaths during or following other types of contact with the police. This includes deaths following contact with the police directly or indirectly that did not involve arrest or detention under the Mental Health Act and were subject to an independent investigation by the Independent Office for Public Conduct, the IOPC. An independent investigation is determined by the IOPC for the most serious incidents that cause the greatest level of public concern, have the greatest potential to impact on communities, or have serious implications for the reputation of the police service. Since 2010-2011, this category has included only deaths that have been subject to an IOPC independent investigation. This is to improve consistency in the reporting of those deaths. Forces must refer such deaths immediately to the IOPC. This may include deaths that occur after the police are called to attend a domestic incident that results in a fatality, deaths that occur while a person is actively attempting to evade arrest, including death being self-inflicted, deaths that occur after the police have been contacted following concerns about a person's welfare and there is concern about the nature of the police response, deaths that occur where the police are called to assist medical staff to restrain individuals who are not under arrest. Christopher's death could be considered a Category 3 death as he was detained in police premises, namely the Queen's Gardens Police Station in the centre of Hull. And some of it does cross over into Category 5 because it was a death following a type of contact with the police directly. But it did involve an arrest. It did not involve an arrest or a detention under the Mental Health Act, but was subject to an IOPC, or at the time, the IOPC had a different name, which we will come to later. So there is definitely circumstances where involvement with the police resulted in a fatality. Now, you may remember that way back in my very first episode, I told you the story of another local case, a lady called Kirsty Carver, who was a civilian police officer who was murdered purely because she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Kirsty worked out of the Queen's Gardens Police Station in Hull, and it is in the centre of Hull, or was in the Hull city centre. And it is that police station that again is the focus of this story. Christopher Alder was born on the 25th of June 1960. He was a black British male of Nigerian descent and he was born in Hull. He joined the British Army at the age of 16 and served in the Parachute Regiment for 6 years. After leaving the army, he first settled in Andover in Hampshire before relocating back to Hull and lived in Dagger Lane, which is in the very centre of the old town area of Hull. He moved back to Hull in 1990, and in 1998 he was taking a college course in computer skills in Hull. He had two sons who had remained with their mother in Andover when their parents separated. On the night in question, the 31st of March 1998, at around 7 in the evening, Christopher and two of his friends went into Hull city centre and visited a few bars in and around the town before going for a takeaway for a bite to eat. Christopher had drunk at that time a couple of bottles of Beck's beer and had a further 2 pints of lager, so was by no means drunk. Following eating some food, he seemed quite sober, and the trio had a conversation as to whether or not to end the night at a nightclub called the Waterfront, which is an old converted warehouse on the side of Prince's Dock in the city centre. Prince's Dock is an unused quay or water basin in the centre of Hull, and has been disused as a dock for many years, and is in fact now home to a shopping centre which is raised above the dock over the water, known as Prince's Quay. Geographically, Hull Marina sits on the very edge of Hull city centre, and previously the marina would have led into Princess Dock, which would then have led into what was known as Queen's Dock. But Queen's Dock had been filled in and turned into a city centre park many years ago. And in fact, Queen's Gardens Police Station is so named as it overlooks that park. So to walk from the Waterfront nightclub to Queen's Gardens Police Station would take you no more than 5 minutes by foot, possibly 10, amble stroll across the park. But Christopher's friends decided against going to the club, so he went there on his own and gained entry at about 10:30 p.m. At the club, Christopher drank a further 2 or 3 pints of lager, and around 1:30 a.m. he became involved in a disagreement with another customer, Jason Ram, which led to Ram being ejected from the club. However, Ram was then caught on the club's external CCTV cameras hanging around outside the club and was in fact waiting for Christopher to leave. So when Christopher left at about 2:15, Ram was waiting for him and again attacked him. A third person, Jason Paul, who was a friend of Christopher's and a member of a local black community group who had organised the club event at the Waterfront nightclub that evening, attempted to break up the fight. And although eyewitnesses' accounts were quite inconsistent, it was mainly suggested that Christopher did strike or connected with blows to Jason Paul when Jason Paul was trying to act as peacekeeper. As the scuffle ensued, Mr. Paul hit him once in the face, which caused Christopher to fall backwards, strike his head on the pavement and lose consciousness. Staff at the nightclub telephoned the emergency services, and an ambulance took Christopher, who had by this time regained consciousness, to the Hull Royal Infirmary. Just before the ambulance left to take Christopher to hospital, two police officers, a PC Nigel Dawson and a PC Neil Blakey, were dispatched to the scene and arrived in a marked patrol car. By this time, Christopher was conscious, but at no time did either of the police officers make any attempt to speak to him. Instead, the two officers spoke to the club manager, who took them inside to review the CCTV footage of the incident. Dawson and Blakey then relayed into the control room that Christopher was very drunk and involved in an altercation, despite the fact that they hadn't spoken to him or discussed his demeanour or what had happened in relation to Jason Ram or Jason Paul with any of the eyewitnesses in or around the club at that time. A third police officer, Acting Police Sergeant Mark Ellerington, then arrived at the club at around 2:50 a.m. By this time, Christopher had left in the ambulance, so Ellerington went inside to speak with the club manager and the two officers already present, and he was at that time told by Dawson and Blakey that Christopher was drunk. Meanwhile, Christopher was on his way to the Accident and Emergency Department at Hull Royal Infirmary. Now, this sits geographically on Anlaby Road, on a large site as part of the Hull Hospitals Trust, and is less than 1 mile from the Waterfront Club. Taking that journey in car would be less than 5 minutes, and the ambulance arrived at the hospital at 2:44 a.m. By this time, Christopher was acting what hospital staff described as troublesome, and although he was cursorily examined by a doctor who thought the head injury did not appear serious, medical staff did try to take an x-ray of his head injury, but he wouldn't remain still, and eventually they abandoned the effort. Several witnesses at A&E described Christopher's behaviour as confused, dazed, and generally abusive. One of the paramedics from the ambulance crew who had transported him there said that Christopher kept saying, "Where am I? What's happened?" One of the nurses who treated him also stated that in addition to being abusive and swearing at her, he was asking, "Where am I? What am I doing?" Two police officers who were present at the emergency department on a completely unrelated matter intervened at one point and asked him to cooperate with the nursing staff. They recalled that he then calmed down but seemed to remain confused. About 20 minutes after Christopher arrived at the hospital, PC Dawson's and Blakey followed on from the club and they wanted to ask him some questions about the assault. Christopher then seemed to become uncooperative again, and the police control room were informed by those officers at 3:19, "Our complainant is a wee bit troublesome, probably the reason why he got smacked in the first place." The doctor who examined Christopher listed his injuries as a hematoma at the rear of his head caused by an impact, but not consistent with a direct blow, which would have been when he struck the pavement after falling backwards when his friend Jason Paul had punched him. Localised swelling to the area of the left side of his upper lip from the punch. Two wounds to the left side of his upper lip, which were not bleeding. Front canine tooth on the left knocked out and the tooth adjacent to it upon the left upper side loosened and pushed into his mouth, and minimal bleeding from the tooth that was knocked out. Now, at this stage, the doctor examining Christopher had several options available. He could admit him for observation overnight in hope that he would sober up and they would also be able to see if there was any serious damage caused by the head injury. They could try and calm him down and x-ray his skull and refer him to the maxillofacial surgeon. Discharge him, which seemed the least likely cause of action, bearing in mind his confused state. But despite that, the doctor did decide to discharge him without seeking any advice from a senior colleague. It may have been this that contributed to the police officer's assumptions that Christopher's condition was not serious. Just before the ambulance left to take Christopher to hospital, two police officers, a PC Nigel Dawson and a PC Neil Blakey, were dispatched to the scene and arrived in a marked patrol car. By this time, Christopher was conscious, but at no time did either of the police officers make any attempt to speak to him. Instead, the two officers spoke to the club manager, who took them inside to review the CCTV footage of the incident. Dawson and Blakey then relayed into the control room that Christopher was very drunk and involved in an altercation, despite the fact that they hadn't spoken to him or discussed his demeanour or what had happened in relation to Jason Ram or Jason Paul with any of the eyewitnesses in on around the club at that time. A third police officer, acting police sergeant Mark Ellerington, then arrived at the club at around 2:50 a.m. By this time, Christopher had left in the ambulance, so Ellerington went inside to speak with the club manager and the two officers already present, and he was at that time told by Dawson and Blakey that Christopher was drunk. Meanwhile, Christopher was on his way to the Accident and Emergency Department at Hull Royal Infirmary, Now, this sits geographically on Anlaby Road on a large site as part of the Hull Hospitals Trust and is less than 1 mile from the Waterfront Club. Taking that journey in car would be less than 5 minutes, and the ambulance arrived at the hospital at 2:44 a.m. By this time, Christopher was acting what hospital staff described as troublesome, and although he was cursorily examined by a doctor who thought the head injury did not appear serious, medical staff did try to take an x-ray of his head injury, but he wouldn't remain still, and eventually they abandoned the effort. Several witnesses at A&E described Christopher's behaviour as confused, dazed, and generally abusive. One of the paramedics from the ambulance crew who had transported him there said that Christopher kept saying, "Where am I? What's happened?" One of the nurses who treated him also stated that in addition to being abusive and swearing at her, he was asking, "Where am I? What am I doing?" Two police officers who were present at the emergency department on a completely unrelated matter intervened at one point and asked him to cooperate with the nursing staff. They recalled that he then calmed down but seemed to remain confused. About 20 minutes after Christopher arrived at the hospital, PC Dawsons and Blakey followed on from the club and they wanted to ask him some questions about the assault. Christopher then seemed to become uncooperative again, and the police control room were informed by those officers at 3:19, "Our complainant is a wee bit troublesome, probably the reason why he got smacked in the first place." The doctor who examined Christopher listed his injuries as a hematoma at the rear of his head caused by an impact, but not consistent with a direct blow, which would have been when he struck the pavement after falling backwards when his friend Jason Paul had punched him. Localised swelling to the area of the left side of his upper lip from the punch. Two wounds to the left side of his upper lip, which were not bleeding. Front canine tooth on the left knocked out and the tooth adjacent to it upon the left upper side loosened and pushed into his mouth. And minimal bleeding from the tooth that was knocked out. Now, at this stage, the doctor examining Christopher had several options available. He could admit him for observation overnight in the hope that he would sober up and they would also be able to see if there was any serious damage caused by the head injury. They could try and calm him down and x-ray his skull and refer him to the maxillofacial surgeon. Discharge him, which seemed the least likely cause of action, bearing in mind his confused state. But despite that, the doctor did decide to discharge him without seeking any advice from a senior colleague. It may have been this that contributed to the police officer's assumptions that Christopher's condition was not serious.
To the police. He's just come from hospital.
He's
trapped in now.
He's right at brain, well, not right at brain, but
he's been in hospital, for sure. He's been abusive to the staff. The staff on the team, he's got a simple hematoma on the back. They call it a simple hematoma, which is obviously a laceration. Refused to be treated, refused to have his head x-rayed.
He's urinating all over the hospital floor.
He was complaining in an assault.
He what?
He was complaining in an assault.
So what should he be arrested for?
Breach of the peace because he wouldn't leave. We came out.
So there, if you can hear that audio, he has been brought into the custody suite and the custody officer is asking why he is there and what's wrong with him. He's told that he received a simple hematoma and that he was the victim of assault, but that he was arrested for breach of the peace because of his behaviour at the hospital and he wouldn't leave.
Grounds and told us to fuck off, he was going back in as soon as we went.
He was on his feet, he says. This is just a
napkin thing.
He kept going down and swan X falling off the trolley. And then when he was outside, he was quite aggressive, quite forthright.
So the breach of the peace is that he wouldn't leave the hospital.
The piece is that he was going to go back into the hospital as soon as we left.
He was shown off the premises.
We asked him to leave. We gave him 5 months worth of options till a van arrived. We still wouldn't go. He funded it up and he was fine and this is acting now. He was up and down in the hospital.
So he was sitting all over. Oh no, it's called Christopher Alder. Going in the dress room yet. He's on our system actually.
And again, they mention he was walking around, that he was quite belligerent, refused to go back into the hospital, and there are quotes that he kept falling off the trolley doing the dying swan. So at that point, Dawson and Blakey leave Christopher lying face down on the custody suite floor, where the CCTV footage shows a pool of blood forming around his mouth. One of the officers comment on the blood, but did not attempt to examine Christopher. PS, or Police Sergeant Dunn, is heard saying that Christopher should be taken to the hospital, to which Dawson and Blakey reply that they have just come from the hospital and that he is feigning unconsciousness. Dawson says, "This is acting now. This is just an acting thing." Blakey says, "He's right as rain. This is a show, this. He kept doing dying swan acts, falling off the trolley," meaning the hospital trolley. A period of 8 minutes and 30 seconds, Christopher lies on the floor, not moving, while the five officers are wandering around behind the desk at the custody suite, chatting.
There's nothing more we can do for him. If he can't be x-rayed, he said something about a simple hematoma to the back of his head. He's got a tooth missing and a tooth dislodged. So what he said is he fit to be detained. And he said, well, I've got my guns and knives in 4 months. There's probably been coming out of his mouth since he's been in hospital. Since he's come out of hospital.
So after 8.5 minutes, there's a comment about the blood coming from his mouth and that he hasn't been moving for quite some time. And it is mentioned that they couldn't follow him around like minders and that the hospital had said it was a very simple hematoma. One of the officers, acting Police Sergeant Ellerington, later stated that he believed Christopher was feigning deep sleep. P.S. Dunn stated that he had formed the opinion, from what he was told, that the man's behaviour at the time was play-acting or attention-seeking. After a few minutes, the handcuffs were removed, but Christopher's arms remained unmoving behind his back, and no attempt was made to examine or rouse him. The officers are seen going in and around the opposite side of the counter, discussing what offences he could be charged with and whether there was any possible justification for holding him, as a potential breach of the peace had clearly passed. On camera, Christopher is heard making gurgling noises as he breathes in and out through the pool of blood around his face. Police Sergeant Dunn later explained that although he was aware of the gurgling, he ignored it, believing Alder was blowing through the blood to try and upset the officers. PC Barr stated later that he believed the noises were intended for our attention. In other words, he was putting it on, which fitted neatly into what he had been told by PC Dawson. The audio track of the CCTV footage appears to show the officers making monkey noises, a common form of racist abuse against black people. Then Christopher went quiet, and at 3:57 a.m. PC Barr points out that he's no longer making any noise, and Police Sergeant Dunn is seen walking around the counter to check on him. They mentioned getting him onto his side and calling an ambulance. The officers began resuscitation attempts and called for an ambulance at 3:59 a.m. It arrived at 4:04 a.m, operated by the same crew who had earlier transported Christopher from the Waterfront nightclub to the Hull Royal Infirmary. Although the ambulance crew had been informed that the casualty had breathing difficulties, the only equipment they took into the custody suite was a bag valve mask. The paramedic admitted later that when they received the call out, he had told his colleagues that it would probably be someone trying to pull a sickie, i.e. to feign illness, to get out of appearing in court the following morning. Therefore, that paramedic had to return to the ambulance outside and collect the necessary equipment, not returning until at least another minute had elapsed. The ambulance technician who first examined Alder reported him as having fixed, dilated pupils, no pulse, not breathing. They ceased CPR at 4:35 a.m. A detective, Inspector Brooks, was at home that night, but was the senior detective on call, and in the early hours of the morning, he was telephoned at home and asked for advice about what should be done. He gave quick instructions that the scene to be preserved, and shortly afterwards attended at Queen's Gardens Police Station, and within a few hours the matter of this death in custody had been reported to the Police Complaints Authority, who in turn commissioned the West Yorkshire Police Service to start an inquiry. West Yorkshire Police were called in to investigate in accordance with police procedures. There were bloodstains in the van and their photographer had photographed them. A forensic scientist was called in to make a report, and when shown the photographs at the inquest, said later that these bloodstains must have been wiped away since they were not in the van when she examined it. A barrister later commented that West Yorkshire Police did not follow many leads that should have been followed. Before the close, worn by the officers involved in the case could be examined forensically, they had been sent for dry cleaning, and the clothes worn by Christopher that night were destroyed. Between the 3rd of July and 24th of August in the year 2000, 2 years after Christopher's death, an inquest took place into his death in Humberside Police custody. An inquest is a judicial inquiry to ascertain the facts relating to an incident. At the inquest, the jury returned a verdict of unlawful killing. It was concluded Christopher died because his ability to breathe was affected by being left face down on the floor. Medical experts who considered the case were unable to reach a conclusion on a single cause of death. The five police officers who were present in the custody suite at the time were called to give evidence at the inquest, but on more than 150 occasions during the hearing, they refused to answer any questions, citing coroner's rules that their response could provide self-incriminating evidence. Shortly after the verdict was returned, the officers, backed by the Police Federation, sought to overturn the verdict by means of a judicial review. A judicial review is a type of court proceeding in which the judge reviews the lawfulness of a decision or action made by a public body, in this case, the decisions made at the inquest. The police officers were requesting a review of the findings of that inquest. Judicial reviews are a challenge to the way in which a decision has been made rather than the rights or wrongs of the conclusion reached. The review is not really concerned with the conclusions of that process and whether they were right, just that the right procedures had been followed. And the court findings in the judicial review will not substitute what it thinks to be the correct decision. This may mean that the public body will still be able to make the same decision again, so long as it does it in what the judicial review findings consider to be a lawful way. The five officers claimed in the review request that the coroner should not have given a verdict of unlawful killing as an option to the jury, as it breaches the duty alleged against them could not amount to gross negligence. They also claim that a female juror had become infatuated with the prosecuting barrister, and there was a real possibility that her infatuation had in fact converted into bias against the police. The application for the judicial review was dismissed by the High Court of Justice in April 2001, and the officers were subsequently charged with misconduct in public office. Meanwhile, at the inquest itself, Christopher's death was seen as one of significant public interest, and a number of interested friends and family were present during the inquest. Authority was given to the police to observe and monitor public order outside of Hull Crown Court where the inquest took place. This was, it was claimed, in order to identify suspects involved in possible offences outside of the court as part of any protests into Christopher's death. However, the surveillance team that took place went far beyond the strictly limited authorised terms of the surveillance order. The operations commander and deputy operations commander of Humberside Police Surveillance Team at the time sanctioned what is known as intrusive surveillance. Janet Alder, Christopher's sister, and her legal representative were followed away from the court to a hotel and to a car park where there was attempts made to listen into their private conversations. Those conversations included or were likely to include matters which were privileged, confidential, and subject to legal professional privilege. The Crown Prosecution Service, who prosecutes on behalf of the state in the UK or in England and Wales, initially decided there was insufficient evidence to pursue criminal charges against the officers. But following a review of the medical evidence, the officers were charged in March 2002 with Christopher's manslaughter. In June 2002, the trial collapsed and the judge ordered the jury to find the officers not guilty on all charges. Following the acquittal, an internal police disciplinary inquiry cleared the officers of any wrongdoing. In July 2003, over 5 years after Christopher's death, the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, challenged the legal correctness of the officers' acquittals and sent the ruling to the Court of Appeal to clarify the threshold for evidence in future death in custody cases. Although this would not affect the acquittal because of the principle of double jeopardy that applied at the time, it would assist in future cases. In April 2004, BBC television series Rough Justice broadcast Death on Camera, a programme examining the circumstances of Christopher's death, including the CCTV footage from the custody suite, which until that point had never been seen by the public. As a result of the programme and the public concern it raised, Home Secretary David Blunkett asked the IPCC to review the case. In December 2004, four of the five police officers were granted early retirement on stress-related medical grounds. They received lump sum compensation payments of between £44,000 and £66,000, as well as their pensions. The officers all declined to take part in the IPCC inquiry. In 2006, the IPCC released its report into their investigation into Christopher's death. It stretched to 400 pages, and the report chairman, Nick Hardwick, described the behaviour of the officers present at the time of Christopher's death as disgraceful. The four officers criticised were PC Matthew Barr, PC Neil Blakey, PC Nigel Dawson and Sergeant John Dunn. The fifth officer, Acting Police Sergeant Mark Ellerington, was also involved but to a lesser extent than the others, the report said. In 2004, it had emerged that all but PC Blakey had since retired on medical grounds, and Mr Hardwick said, "I believe the failure of the police officers concerned to assist Mr. Alder effectively on the night he died were largely due to assumptions they made about him based on negative racial stereotypes." I do believe the fact he was black stacked the odds more heavily against him. Mr. Hardwick said that although there were serious failings by the four police officers, they did not assault Mr. Alder and could not be said with certainty to have caused his death, but their neglect undoubtedly did deny him the chance of life. Humberside Police Federation spokesman John Savage said the officers denied they had neglected their duties or acted in a racist manner, unwittingly or otherwise. It was also discovered that Christopher's clothes were destroyed by a West Yorkshire team investigating the death and never subjected to any forensic examination. Chief Constable Tim Hollis, who was not with the force at the time of Christopher's death, said after the report was released, "The time is right for me publicly to apologise to Christopher Alder's family for our failure to treat Christopher with sufficient compassion and to the desired standard that night. The failure of the officers to explain to the IPCC their actions, including noises recorded on the video before and after Christopher's arrival in the custody suite, appears to have contributed to the IPCC view regarding unwitting racism." In September 2006, Leon Wilson, one of Alder's sons, went to the High Court to challenge the Home Office's refusal to reopen the case. The judge rejected his case, saying it was legally reasonable for the Secretary of State to believe that no more worthwhile evidence was likely to emerge. But the story did not stop there. In November 2011, Christopher's body was discovered in the mortuary at Hull Royal Infirmary 11 years after his family believed they had buried him. An exhumation of his grave was then taken place in Hull's Northern Cemetery during the night of the 21st of February 2012. And in place of Christopher's body, they found that a Grace Kamara, a 77-year-old woman, had been buried in his place. Both bodies have since been reburied. South Yorkshire Police Detective Superintendent Richard Fuchs announced that a criminal investigation had begun to determine if an offence of misconduct in public office had been committed following the release of the wrong body to the Alder family. Again, grief and pain was brought to Janet and Christopher's two sons, and again they found very little comfort in the findings of subsequent investigations. South Yorkshire Police said, on the 29th of April 2013, Fuchs and his investigative team presented a detailed and extensive investigation report to the Crown Prosecution Service to seek formal advice relating to a number of mortuary staff to establish if they had committed any criminal offences. After careful consideration of all the circumstances and the evidence available, the Crown Prosecution Service has concluded that there is no real prospect of a conviction for either misconduct in a public office or the prevention of a lawful burial of a body. Detective Superintendent Richard Fuchs, who led the investigation, said, "While the investigation will not lead to a criminal prosecution, I am now in a position to explain to the families of Christopher Alder and Grace Kamara the likely circumstances that may have led to these tragic events." It was during this investigation in 2013 the actual facts of the underhand surveillance of grieving sister Janet came to light as taking place at the time of her brother's inquest and then afterwards. It led to yet another investigation by the IPCC, who found evidence of a case to answer for gross misconduct for four officers, two of whom, the most senior officers, had already retired. Humberside Police declined to bring proceedings against those officers involved, but a gross misconduct hearing into intrusive and unauthorised police surveillance of a bereaved family during an inquest ruled, and Humberside Police were then directed to do so in respect of the two officers who were still serving. Those two officers were given anonymity during the misconduct hearing. They said they believed they were carrying out lawful orders given from higher up in the command chain. Evidence was given by a number of former senior officers at Humberside Police who denied ordering the operation, and the hearing was unable to establish the source of its authorisation. Evidence was also given that surveillance officers could be told to follow individuals without being told why. The tribunal sat in Goole in East Yorkshire, which is along the M62, about a 30 to 40 minute drive from Hull. They were told by lawyers representing the two officers that they acted on the instructions of more senior officers. Sam Green, QC, who acted for Officer 2, said his client was at a loss to know what he was supposed to do once instructed to carry out highly sensitive surveillance. He believed he was carrying out lawful orders. Evidence was heard from a number of senior officers who all denied the spying operation. The tribunal, which found that the two detective sergeants had no case to answer, and in a statement, Detective Chief Superintendent Judy Heaton of Humberside Police said, "We know that this has been a distressing time for Ms. Alder and her family. We do understand her frustration that the exact details around the case have not been able to be established." Deborah Coles, who is the director of inquest.org, released the statement, "It is reprehensible that police spied on a bereaved sister and her lawyer during an inquest. This was a clear attempt to intimidate and undermine their attempt to get the truth about the brutal reality of Christopher's death. The unlawful killing of Christopher Alder is of significant public interest, as it is the shocking treatment of his family in the following years. We hope this hearing will identify appropriate sanctions for those involved in this gross invasion of privacy. At a time when the undercover policing inquiry is yet to hear evidence, this hearing is an important moment in the wider public understanding of invasion and inappropriate police spying." This was not the only tactic Humberside Police engaged in to try and deflect attention away from their handling of Christopher's arrest and subsequent death. Jason Paul, as you will remember, was Christopher's friend who was the one that struck him in the altercation outside the club and caused him to be initially unconscious and behave erratically. Eventually had to bring a claim against the Chief Constable of Humberside Police for damages as to what he claimed was a catalogue of police behaviours clearly showing that they tried to make him a scapegoat into Christopher's death. Following the incident outside the club, Jason Paul was interviewed on several occasions. In the course of the first interview, he was arrested for causing grievous bodily harm in substitution for the arrest for murder. Jason Paul was charged with causing GBH with intent under Section 18 of Offences Against the Person Act of 1861. The police refused to give him bail, but he was subsequently released on bail by the Magistrates Court, subject to a condition that he reside in a bail hostel away from Hull. The CPS indicated that they were reminded that proceedings against Jason Paul be discontinued. At this point, officers then expressed concern about this and made representations to the CPS that Jason Paul should be charged. However, the CPS did discontinue the proceedings, and they considered that Jason Paul could rely on self-defence to justify his actions outside of the club. Jason Paul brought a claim for false imprisonment, malicious prosecution, and misfeasance in a public office. He contended his arrest for murder was unlawful, a contention that the arrest for causing GBH was unlawful and was abandoned. However, he contended that there was no reasonable or probable cause to charge him with a Section 18 offence. There was no intent. The police were motivated by a desire to deflect criticism away from themselves and to use him as a suitable scapegoat. He also contended that the police were guilty of misfeasance in public office in continuing to support an unjustified charge, although this was clearly abandoned by the CPS. In 2003, a judge dismissed Jason's case on the grounds there was no factual evidence of police deceit, but the Court of Appeal overturned his decision and ordered another trial in March of the next year. An 8-strong jury ruled in favour of Mr. Paul on a series of questions posed by the judge. They agreed unanimously that it was more likely than not that the police charged Jason Paul with causing GBH with intent to deflect any potential criticism of the circumstances of Christopher Alder's death away from the Humberside police. They also decided, by a margin of 7-1, that it was more likely than not that the instruction to arrest for murder was given to deflect potential criticism of the circumstances of Christopher Alder's death. Outside court, Mr. Paul said, "I'm relieved that after 8 years my name has been cleared. A jury of my peers has publicly recognised that I was wrongly arrested on suspicion of murder and then charged with GBH with intent because the police needed a scapegoat to avoid potential criticism of the circumstances of the death in police custody of Christopher Alder. I wish the Alder family success with their continuing fight for justice against Humberside Police." Following that catalogue of appalling events, Janet and the family are still no further in receiving justice for the loss of Christopher. Speaking to the Yorkshire Post in 2020, Janet said, "All I can think about is the amount of lies involved in Christopher's case. It is absolutely disgusting. We buried Christopher in 2000 and then again in 2011 after I found out his body was still in the mortuary. It was a 77-year-old Nigerian lady we buried. She had been in the mortuary at the time as her family couldn't get a visa to come over after she died. South Yorkshire Police investigated the mix-up. I believe that the evidence is there and they've dismissed it, but my solicitor said there was no reasonable investigator who could have messed those up. Personally, I just think they didn't want to go through with all the paperwork. Police were asking me all the questions and tried to turn it on me as if I was the one that was responsible. They asked me who released Christopher's body from the mortuary that day. How would I know that? It's not my job to know things like that." South Yorkshire Police told the Yorkshire Post it was aware of the concerns raised by Miss Alder and was currently exploring the details of those concerns. Over the years, the case has garnered support from local justice campaigners, in particular from the Black Lives Matter movement, who in 2020 asked Miss Alder to speak at a protest in Hull City Centre. She said, "I couldn't not speak at that protest. What happened with George Floyd triggered everything again for me. I think racism in this country is hidden a lot better. Why do people not know about Christopher's case when it's so horrific? It's definitely been kept under wraps more. Last year, some 18 people died either in or directly after being in police custody in England and Wales, according to the figures released last month by police watchdog IOPC. Of those, 14 were white, 3 were black, and 1 was ethnicity not recorded. The number of black British people who die in custody remains disproportionate, as they make up only 3% of the overall population." Janet Alder continues to crowdfund. Her statement on her crowdfunding page says, "I am taking a legal challenge against South Yorkshire Police to challenge the investigation with the hope that no family will ever have to go through what I have been through. Please support me and donate to my fight for justice." She has raised a little over £16,000 of the £40,000 required to this date. And I will put a link in the episode show notes to the Crowd Justice page so you can donate if you want to Christopher's family. Thank you for listening. And as always, be kind to each other. Thank you. If you enjoyed that episode, please go back and look at some of my previous episodes, have a listen, or go to my blog a link of which I'll put in the episode description. I don't receive any money for my podcasts, but it is nice to know that there are people out there listening, and certainly with stories like Christopher, there is a hope that we can make a difference. Take care.